I move that Hillary Clinton be selected as the nominee of the Democratic Party for President of the United States.
I am so happy. It's been a great day and night. What an incredible honor that you have given me. And I can't believe we just put the biggest crack in that glass ceiling yet.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. It is 5:08, and it is Wednesday. It's the July 27th, 2016, Wednesday as we move to midweek. Welcome to another edition of The Opening Bell. Welcome to another business day. And aside from politics, you really do have to say, you go, girl. The glass ceiling, pieces of glass falling everywhere. Let's get some more female CEOs, right? We need some more female CEOs, another couple of world leaders. It's something we've talked about a lot here on The Opening Bell, about pairing this up, evening this out, how there is an absence of female CEOs all around the world. Maybe we can address that more as we move forward here on The Opening Bell this year. But it certainly opens it up for discussion when you have a female president, or at least a female presidential nominee. And now the real fighting begins. We have two official nominees. We'll see what the markets do, how they react, how business reacts as we make it official now. It's all official. We've all been saying presumptive up until now. But we can take that title off of both of the candidates as we now move toward the fall election. Big speeches coming up as our coverage of the Democratic Convention continues here on WGN throughout the morning on the Steve Cochran Show, right here on The Opening Bell as well. Let's start first at the WGN market desk this morning. You heard Vic give you some of the numbers, but here in the United States, Dow futures are a little bit higher this morning, pushing a little bit higher. The S&P and NASDAQ futures higher as well. In Europe, generally higher as well. All of the indices higher. In Asia, pretty much the same story. A couple of big stories making the news today. Of course, in Japan, it is the central bank there and the government appear ready to offer a fresh dose of economic stimulus to revive stalling growth. And that's why we've seen some of the numbers up there over the last few days. Shares in Tokyo jumped today after the Fuji TV network reported that the prime minister planned to introduce a new economic stimulus package amounting to about 27 trillion yen. That's 27 trillion yen, about $240 billion, something the Japanese economy needs and something that might affect all of the rest of the markets as well. Here in the United States, the Federal Open Market Committee scheduled to release its latest monetary policy later today after wrapping up a two-day meeting. We'll focus a little bit on this later on today, whether the Federal Reserve will change its policy this month about the sentiment about raising interest rates this year. They did not at their last meeting, probably won't this time either. But the big news about this is, will they finally admit that they won't do it for the rest of the year? And that'll be part of our conversation later in the Opening Bell. Also today, a French parliamentarian visiting Mississippi as part of an effort to pressure Nissan to allow workers at its Canton plant to organize a union. Christian Houghton is a deputy chairman of the Social Affairs Commission of the French National Assembly. He'll be meeting today with workers, lawmakers, and others, supporters of the United Auto Workers, in an effort to unionize about 6,200 people there. Also, LG Display, a supplier of Apple's iPhone screen, says it will invest 1.9 trillion won, which is about $2 billion, to produce flexible displays for smartphones. This is important because I bet you've broke or cracked one of your smartphone displays at some point, or fear it every day. This will actually help prevent that. You'll be able to bend your screen on your iPhone or whatever smartphone you have. It's a new technology that's been tested, being tested, now moving to market. The candidates obviously are big news these days after the convention, the Republican convention just over, the Democratic convention just over. They are certainly big on social media. Donald Trump also says a lot on social media. If you follow his account, he tries to put on 140 characters regularly during the day. What can we learn about the social habits of these two on social media? And we've gone to Brandwatch to answer that question today. And with us this morning is Kellen Terry. Kellen, good morning. Welcome to the Opening Bell.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Brandwatch has put together a summary, really, an infographic. You've put it all in sort of graphic detail about what these candidates look like socially on social media, how their supporters are faring, what they look like. Give us a snapshot of what you found.
Well, a snapshot essentially is we looked at around 100 million tweets over about a six-month period to see what the typical or stereotypical Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton supporter kind of looked like on Twitter, on the social web. And we found that once we filtered those mentions through kind of pro-speech filters to make sure that we were filtering out people who might be criticizing the candidate, we saw what their supporters looked like. And what we saw was Hillary, she was clearly being talked up and being supported by women, as 61.7% of all pro-Hillary tweets came from women, while Donald Trump's gender split was very close to 50-50, with men only having a very slight majority there at 50.3%. We went through and we went on to look at the professions that these people identified themselves as having. Hillary resonated very well with artists and teachers and executives, while Donald Trump resonated very well with executives and health practitioners. Then we looked at their interests. We saw that Hillary Clinton supporters were really focused on their family and parenting and books and music and really the arts. But when we looked at Donald Trump, we saw that family and parenting was very important to them as well, but then their other interests kind of lied within the sporting arenas and the business world. And then when we looked at states that talked about them the most positively, in finding these metrics, we looked at positive mentions versus negative mentions within each and every state. We saw that Hillary was being talked about most positively in Delaware and South Dakota and Alaska, while Donald Trump was being talked about most positively within South Carolina, Montana, and Alabama. And we think that these kind of social statistics kind of really give a nice picture or a snapshot of what a typical supporter of these candidates, where they come from, what their interests lie in, what their daily activities and routines look like.
From ABC News, Wall Street Now, I'm Dave Schreiber. Asian stocks were mixed today ahead of the Federal Reserve's policy statement. The Japanese Prime Minister has announced plans for a fresh barrage of economic stimulus to help revive stalling growth. On Wall Street, stocks were mixed after a day spent wavering between small gains and losses. The Dow lost 19 points. The S&P edged up less than a point, and the NASDAQ rose 12 points. It is Tesla Motors' biggest bet yet, a big $5 billion factory in the Nevada desert that could nearly double production of lithium-ion batteries. Tesla officially opened the factory Tuesday, a little more than 2 years after construction started. The factory is about 14% complete. The Federal Open Market Committee is set to release its latest monetary policy statement later today after wrapping up a two-day meeting. Dave Schreiber, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. We're on this morning with Kellen Terry of Brandwatch. We're talking about the social media influence, the social DNA, really, of the two presidential candidates, now official nominees of their party, Hillary and Donald. And Kellen, before we went away, we were kind of giving people a snapshot of things, and I'd like to get more into this. First of all, kudos to the graphic artist who did the infographic. I think you've nailed Hillary's pantsuit and Donald's hair perfectly.
Thank you. That was definitely what we were going for. Even without really kind of having a picture to go from, we wanted you to know who they were once you saw them.
Right. So this is the big question as you move forward, and I'm guessing you're going to keep monitoring this, but have you ever seen these numbers that we've gone through, the brief numbers, change as the campaign goes along? Is that something that you might expect as now that the nominations are done and the official big campaigning gets underway? Will these numbers change?
I think absolutely the numbers will change. I think that reflects kind of where we are in this political cycle. Like you said, we are through with the primary stage and there's no more presumptive title. We know who the nominees from each party are. And because we know that, we not only know who is going to represent their party, but who they are going to go against. So I think that these numbers will certainly change, especially when it comes to a conversation sentiment towards these candidates. We can also track and analyze sentiment within mentions from the social web. And taking into consideration who a candidate is running against will oftentimes play a major role in those sentiments.
One of the things that jumped off of the page at me when I look at this infographic is the DNA is the info where these people live, where the supporters live. The people who support Hillary live in an apartment. The people who support Donald Trump live in a mansion. That's huge.
Absolutely. When we set out to make this infographic, right from the concept, we really wanted to blend and overlay different data sets. At Brandwatch, we're a big proponent of that. We think that social data and analytics can really stand on its own, but it shines brighter when you add different third-party data sets and to kind of paint a more complete picture. So what we did is we went to a third-party research center, which isn't officially affiliated with this infographic, but we just overlaid our social insights with some of their findings from a national survey. And what we found was stereotypical liberals and stereotypical conservatives. Conservatives prefer kind of the larger houses in terms of square footage that are in more rural areas where you have to kind of drive to go to the movies, to go to a restaurant. Whereas stereotypical liberals, they would rather live in smaller apartment-type residence with less square footage as long as amenities are closer and within walking distance.
One of the other things that jumped off the page, too, was about Donald Trump, the number of women who are his social media supporters. One would think that would be lower given the, at least in the media and public attention that's been given to what people are calling his, you know, his just this feeling against women.
Absolutely. Like I kind of said earlier, the gender split is very close to 50-50. And one would suspect that women wouldn't be as pro-Trump as this infographic shows. But I think that that also goes to show that even though he might make a comment, people are sticking within their party or they believe in kind of his platform, his reforms on immigration that he's been proposing and the like. So maybe they're overlooking those comments that some people point to and they want to draw your attention to, and they kind of tend to focus more on his statements towards the issues.
Do you think that we would be able to use this social media to gauge political activity of smaller races? I know you've done it in this big race, but is it something that you can extrapolate and use for smaller, like governor's races or even local races, like for mayor of Chicago when that comes around?
Absolutely, and especially in a city like Chicago that has such a large population. It'd be really easy to kind of look at the social conversation. You could limit it in scope to geography if you wanted to, and then just really pull out these type of insights for no matter the race, whether it's on a national scale, as is this presidential race, or on a more local scale as for like a mayor race of a major city.
This infographic, is it just based on U.S. users, or have you included users around the world? And if you put those in, what would you think it would change if it's not in there?
So this infographic is all users all over. Well, for some figures, it is all users, but for other figures, it is just within the U.S. When we set out from the beginning, we really wanted to include all mentions, too, because being president of the United States is not only a job within the United States. You have, of course, your foreign relations and you have to work internationally as well. So we wanted to make sure to gather those mentions, those international mentions, which would lead to insights about how the potential candidate is being perceived overseas in certain nations. But yes, we do look just within the states and beyond.
Now, I know that in doing infographics, you're sort of limited in what you can put in the square. Is there anything, any data that you didn't put in this infographic that you think maybe people should know about?
Absolutely. Within our platform, we're able to kind of categorize and rule out different mentions. So something that we've been doing from the very beginning is we've been kind of categorizing and picking out mentions around political issues. And we would have liked to have really included that into this infographic, but from a very early stage, we kind of said that we wanted this infographic to be about the supporters of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, and not necessarily about the issues that the candidates tend to hang their hat on. When we look at the data, say, around the Republican National Convention, which wrapped up last week, we did apply those categories to those mentions to see what types of issues were coming forward as the most talked about political issues that those people were most concerned about.
I noticed on the celebrities, most influential celebrity on each side, Dennis Rodman for Donald Trump and Jamie Lee Curtis for Hillary Clinton. Couldn't be too stark of differences, right?
That is correct. They are very different. This stat line came about as this is more of a popular mention within the pro-candidate conversation. And, of course, we had to filter out some mentions. Donald Trump obviously sits at the top of his own conversation. Like you said earlier, he's very prominent on Twitter. He tweets often, and when he does, people tend to listen, and they tend to spread that tweet far and wide. So we wanted to take out tweets that came from the candidate themselves or from the candidate's campaign group or someone who is a known associate of that candidate and is part of their organization. So when we had Dennis Rodman, I believe it came the night of a debate, of a Republican debate, and it was kind of aimed at Ted Cruz. And the reason that we picked up this mention was because he used a pro Donald Trump hashtag, hashtag Make America Great Again. So that one tweet was very kind of one of the most popular tweets within the overall conversation coming from a celebrity. And the same thing with Jamie Lee Curtis. She was showing her support on social media for Hillary Clinton, and it just kind of rose above kind of the general mentions of people of the general public.
Kellen Terry, thank you for being with us today of BrandWatch. Of course, you can find out more about this infographic at BrandWatch.com and follow on Twitter at BrandWatch. Kellen, before we let you go real quickly, just on social media, people are asking where Gary Johnson is, the third-party choice. So it might be a question you could answer on social media later if you maybe do one of these for the third party as well.
Absolutely. We have been looking into the third-party candidates to set up queries for them as well. We've just been looking at the Republican and the Democratic candidates so far because they've had the primary kind of campaign cycle going up and everything. But we are certainly exploring the option of adding third-party candidates like Gary Johnson. Yes. Right.
Very good, Kellen. Thank you. Thanks for being on the opening bell.
From ABC News Tech Trends, I'm Alex Stone. Do you know somebody who spends hours and hours at the computer working or gaming? A desk made just for them. Anybody who sits at a desk for many hours knows the pains that can come along with it. Arosi, a brand known by hardcore gamers, they make special gaming chairs, extra comfy, speakers in them. Now they've come out with a gaming desk.
Game with freedom and for as long as they like, on into the night.
But really, Scott Richards with Arosi says it could be good for anybody who sits at a desk looking at a computer screen for hours on end.
Our desk is 5.5 feet wide and about 2.75 feet deep, and it gives people to put three monitors up.
And the entire desktop is made out of mouse pad material.
The whole thing is topped with a mouse pad that fits 100% of the surface. And the mouse pad, by the way, is also cleanable.
It's made out of wood and metal, no plastic. The price tag of the Arosi desk, about $350. With Tech Trends, I'm Alex Stone, ABC News.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. 540 as our morning conversation continues, focusing now on the Federal Reserve, expected to make its monthly economic pronouncement later today after finishing 2 days of meetings. Most analysts think the key words again will be wait and see. With consumer spending, employers hiring more freely, the U.S. economy has fared better of late. But the Fed is expected to look for further gains before raising interest rates again. Let's join Greg McBride now, who is with us from Bankrate.com. He's the chief financial analyst there. Greg, good morning. Welcome to the Opening Bell.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
The question, I think the two words, three words I want to pull out of that introduction there are wait and see. And that is something that really has been giving the market sort of a stomachache over the last 6 months to a year. It seems there's not a direction, or at least a firm direction. Would you agree with that? Is that also what you're seeing and hearing?
Well, I think with the Fed taking that type of stance, I think, if anything, I think they're undermining confidence in the economy. When you look at the economic fundamentals, it suggests that interest rates ought to be considerably higher than they are right now. And the economic data is a lot better now than it was when they met 6 weeks ago in June. So, you know, I think that meeting-to-meeting stance that they have, I think really it's made them overly data-dependent. If you look at what we've seen just since the last meeting, the stronger jobs report really put that bad May jobs report, you know, in the rearview mirror. We've seen better news on retail spending, industrial production, housing starts. So, you know, the economy is doing well enough, certainly to justify an interest rate increase. It's time for the Fed to start setting the table so that they've got the option to do so in September if these conditions persist.
Because I think they were waiting until after Brexit to see what the impact on that would be. But as you say, and I'm going to pull this out again so people hear it very clearly, the economy seems to be strong enough to support an interest rate. Is that what I hear you saying? Interest rate increase?
Yeah, without a doubt. And you're right. They did want to wait till the other side of the Brexit. But, you know, as we've seen, you know, Brexit's kind of come and gone. The stock market has recovered all those losses and then gone on to set new record highs. So they don't have that. I think they're, you know, really, frankly, kind of running out of excuses. If they really expect that they're going to raise interest rates once or even twice this year, they've got to get busy because they only have limited opportunities to do so. They have to use today's announcement as a stepping stone to give themselves the option of raising interest rates at their September meeting if conditions persist. They can always backpedal away from it if things change. We've seen plenty of that this year. But what they can't do is raise interest rates if nobody's expecting them to do so.
And it seems unlikely that they would do that, raise interest rates at their September meeting, just because Election Day is coming up very quickly after that.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the calendar, you know, I mentioned they have really limited opportunities to raise interest rates in the remainder of the year. They have a meeting in November, but it's 6 days before the election. So you can cross that one off the list. Historically, Fed doesn't want to have any perception of influence on elections or politics. So, you know, scratch November off the list. So that leaves September or December. Now, September, even that is 7 weeks before the election. It's in the height of the debate season. I think even that one's questionable from a timing standpoint. The Fed could certainly weasel their way out of raising rates at that point. So what does that leave you with? December, a full 12 months since the previous rate hike. And, you know, looking at the economic fundamentals, I think it's a real stretch to say at this point that they can afford to wait till December. You know, I really think that they need to keep September as an active or what they call live meeting, just so they have the option of doing so.
There has been discussion even on this program in the past about whether people on Wall Street are listening to the Fed at all. Some have said they've even stopped paying attention to the Fed because of this wishy-washiness. Do you see that as existing? And what would you say about whether or not the market really is even paying attention to what the Fed does?
Now, the Fed has certainly lost a lot of credibility, and you said it, because of that wishy-washiness, because of what I would call being overly data dependent. You know, the idea that, you know, that the fundamentals could all be in good shape, and then we get one economic report that's, you know, questionable, and then all of a sudden that changes the outlook entirely. You know, again, I think that undermines confidence in both the economy and the Fed itself. You know, the projections of the Fed, they have this habit of overestimating economic performance and overestimating what they think they're going to do on interest rates. And then they have to, you know, they spend the rest of the year sort of ratcheting both of those back. And I think that, too, has really undermined their credibility with markets.
And I think on the flip side of this political discussion in this, people have always accused the Fed of making their decisions to support whatever party is in power. But I think the fact that they're not doing anything, that they're not moving forward on interest rates, that they seemingly don't think the economy is strong enough, that would be, some could argue that's sending the message to the other party that the economy is not strong enough.
Well, I mean, that's the thing about politics, right? Each side is going to kind of, you know, they're going to see it through their own lenses. You know, I don't know. You know, honestly, I don't know that you can necessarily draw any conclusions, you know, about that. I think, you know, the other thing that the Fed has pointed to time and time again throughout the year are developments on the international front. So even when, you know, everything's going okay with regard to the U.S. economy, they've been able to fall back on weakness overseas or some sort of financial turmoil elsewhere in the world to be able to not raise interest rates. Look, if you're going to wait for world peace and harmony, you're never going to raise interest rates.
So, Greg, give us a sense of what the economy could handle right now in terms of an interest rate. If they were to do it, what do you think they would do?
Well, they would only do a quarter point rate hike. And again, the soonest we would see that would be September. They're not going to do so today. And at quarter point, it's a baby step. And the fact is, they've got to get a few more of these rate hikes under their belt, because right now they don't have anything to combat an economic slowdown or a recession whenever one should materialize. And while the economy is doing well right now, we don't necessarily have that immediate concern. We will eventually. And at that time, if they haven't raised interest rates, if they drag their feet too much, you know, there's going to be a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking about the Fed, because they won't have any tools that can effectively combat a recession.
Greg McBride, who's the chief financial analyst at Bankrate.com. You can check them out. Again, Bankrate.com. Greg, good conversation this morning. Thanks for being with us.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the program on the WGN Market Desk this morning. The Dow future is up about 39. The S&P and NASDAQ futures pointing up as well. Let's get the latest on commodities now, see what the markets over there are doing. And good morning, Orion Samuelson.
And good morning, Steve. Yesterday it was wheat's turn to take the big hit. Chicago Board of Trade wheat futures down as much as 3% yesterday. Largest daily losses in 3 weeks. The American wheat harvest moving toward conclusion with better than expected yields and continued world supply outpacing the demand for wheat. And so for the second straight session, we saw the wheat market move lower at the Board of Trade. And corn futures yesterday, a little bit of a rally in the corn contract. It moved up yesterday to, or rather down yesterday by the close. It was on both sides during the day, but down 2 cents at the end of the day. Soybeans came back just a little bit, up 9 3/4. And the cattle market continued to show strength yesterday. Live cattle futures in the August contract up 92 cents. And closed above the 40-day moving average. And basically, because of a stronger beef market, Morning's Choice beef price, the cutout jumped $1.44 a hundredweight from Monday and ended yesterday at 3 cents over $200. Select cuts up $1.87 to $191.31. Continued trouble for the pork producers, though. Profit-taking, and yesterday we saw the August hog contract down $1.07 a hundredweight, $74.60. And the government reported yesterday's average cash hog price in Iowa, Minnesota, down 82 cents from Monday to $70.60 in light sales volume. Today, final day of the U.S. Grange Council meeting in Louisville, but it's opening day at the Lake County Fair at Gray's Lake. That fair runs through Sunday. Have a good day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
And Orion, before we let you go here, we were wondering if you had a chance to look over the Democratic Convention speakers rundown, because I know as we talked last week, there was concern among farmers they hadn't heard anything from Donald Trump. It doesn't look like there's much on the schedule for the Democrats either.
I don't think they have yet found the word agriculture in the dictionary. I hope they will before the convention's over. But, you know, nothing else happens in this country without agriculture, because we have to eat. And yet they name all of the other professions, but they don't talk agriculture. And again, both parties' attitude on trade agreements and trade, totally negative, and I don't understand.
And it's really confusing, because we start out the whole process in agriculture. We start out with Iowa. I don't understand why we're not talking about it now.
They talked about it in Iowa, but they did that simply to refer to renewable fuels, ethanol and biodiesel. But they didn't talk about food, and they didn't talk, you know, they're talking about trade agreements costing American jobs. I think it's lower labor costs in other countries that move jobs to those countries, and it's not the trade agreements that do that, because trade agriculturally in this country is the one major segment where we have a positive trade balance. And I keep talking about it, but they don't listen.
Well, maybe they'll be listening at some point. Thanks, Orion. Have a great day.